Okay. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and you all kind of missed out on the disclaimer, but I'm going to say it again. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of Ferris State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame, but we hope that you all will agree with some of them. Again, this is the place where we talk to people who are on the battlefield. We connect the struggles that are going on in this country. And this is a good time to remind you that we still have a serial liar and a 34-time convicted felon in the White House that is wreaking havoc on not only this country, but the world. And he's being abated and abetted by Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court. So that makes our fight, y'all, tremendously harder, but we have to continue to fight. We have in the studio and then on the phone, we have two attorneys, and we're going to talk about what it's like to be in the courtroom these days. But, you know, they're here for a particular reason. In studio is Maureen Hanlon, who is with Arch City Defenders. And, you know, she is with the civil litigation, so she's worked on issues like, you know, the jail conditions, the police brutality, and those kinds of issues. On the phone, because he's hot out of the courtroom in Jefferson City, is Brendan Roediger, who is with St. Louis Law University, their clinic, and he's no stranger to this show, but welcome both of you all, Maureen and Brendan.
Excited to be here.
So I'm going to start with, we have two attorneys here who are bright, who are very committed. Why are you all not choosing to do corporate law where you could make a ton of money and where we learned at a forum on Thursday that some of the attorneys in the city councilor's office are jumping ship because they're now working with a contracted law firm where they will make oodles of money? It is an alluring kind of proposition. How do you all do that? Maureen first.
Well, I don't think any lawyers in today's America need to be complaining about being at the bottom of the financial totem pole. So I think there are many working people in this country who don't get paid anything like what would be fair wages. And I think for most attorneys, I don't think we're in that same bucket. So I will say that I think my personal decisions are based off of wanting to feel engaged and passionate about my work and wanting to be doing things that are interesting. And I am lucky to have great clients like one Jamala Rogers sitting 1 foot away from me. So that is priceless. Can't put a price on that. No. You know, I think people make different decisions. There's no, what's the saying about no perfect choices under capitalism? Mm-hmm. So people go through different phases of life. Far be it from me to judge anyone from doing anything, but I like to feel like I'm trying something. Who knows if it's always working? Brendan, you got a good answer?
Oh, no, I do not. So first of all, only one of us is bright. but I will, so I've been teaching law school now for 16 years. And because I sort of came into this work because of my politics, meaning I decided to be a lawyer based on the idea that I could be of service to movements by being a lawyer, I came in with a pretty sort of hard mindset around students that sort of claimed to be social justice oriented but went to take corporate jobs. And I have to admit I've softened on that just by virtue of, you know, realizing that I have so many students. I teach at St. Louis U where there are a lot of working class students who are in this sort of unique opportunity to change generational outcomes. And that's a hard position to be in. And so I have those conversations with those students, but like Maureen said, I've just gotten a lot less judgmental over time because it's not a position that I found myself in.
Hmm. Now, this is about the third time I've heard you do some self-deprecation, and I don't think that's good. And so we're going to have an offline discussion about that.
Wow.
Attorney, counselor.
Wow.
Yes, you are very bright. I wouldn't even have you in my orbit, okay? If you were a dumb bunny, uncommitted, you think you'd be on this program?
Mm.
Okay.
Then. Wow.
Act accordingly. Act accordingly.
I'm in trouble already.
Yeah. That's good. I'm going to use that.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that. And once I heard that on Thursday that people were jumping ship, I'm like, yeah, wow. To stay committed. And even for somebody like me who could be drawn into other more profitable arenas, you know, I guess for some people, particularly younger people, that is a very contagious, infectious kind of, line, hook, a hooker. It's going to be a hook.
Right.
Yeah. So let's talk about this lawsuit, because you all represent two different clients, Maureen and her staff, her team is representing myself and Mike Milton, who's with Freedom Community Center, and we are playing this as individual citizens, not an organization, so I just want to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
But you, Brendan, represent Megan Green, who is president of the Board of Alders. So let's talk a little bit about that, and I know people keep asking, well, what happened to the city's lawsuit. We could talk about that. So let's talk about the city lawsuit. There was one that was about either pending or about to be.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with that once Cara Spencer was elected mayor of the city of St. Louis?
So as I understand it, and Brendan, feel free to chime in, the city was never going to be the plaintiff. Megan Green was a plaintiff and still is a plaintiff, and it's, from my understanding, more about the venue in which it's filed, so now in state court, and just about kind of the team of support. But Brendan, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. You talked about the fact, Jamala, that you're not representing any organization, and President Green is not representing the city. She also is suing in her individual capacity. It is true that the prior lawsuit, which was filed in federal court not all that long ago, also involved Megan Green, but there the city counselor was her counsel, and the city was on board with the lawsuit. It appears that the city is no longer interested in litigation around this issue.
And that change coincided with the changing of the mayor, but like many decisions that involve the city and the city councilor, it's a bit inscrutable. So it's not clear whether that decision was made by the interim city councilor. It's not clear if that decision was made by Mayor Spencer. As a taxpayer, I'd love to know more about the city's legal decision, but we don't.
And what difference would that have made if the mayor herself had been a plaintiff?
Well, so, you know, I think like Brendan said, I don't know that it would have made a big difference, because I think the legal concerns that are being raised by all parties are pretty consistent. And so I think that the city may need to cooperate in terms of some producing supporting documents or things like that. But
I can't hear you.
I don't know. I'm biased. I think Megan's got two of the best lawyers in the state working for her. So I'm not I'm not sure that the city councilor bowing out is really jeopardizing the movement, but it is, of course, a bummer that all parties aren't kind of rowing together.
Yeah, another really good question. I think for me, is this particular judge going to be making decisions based on the fact that the city councilor is not present? No, this is a good judge. We'll look at the law. I think from a sort of long-term political perspective, the messaging is bad. If you imagine a world in which we are successful and people in Jeff City are sort of, getting together, deciding whether to pass new legislation to accomplish the same thing, the fact that our own city government took no stance on it is not going to work in our favor.
Yeah. So I think, I think Mayor Spencer was publicly very critical of the takeover, and I hope that continues. So, pre-election, she was very public. Pre-election, she was publicly, as then Mayor Jones were. I think both of them were clear that they did not think it was in the interest of the city. And I hope that now that it's happening, now that it is upon us, we are under state control, that some of that continues.
Well, I do have to say, and this is another question I often get asked, pre-election, Kara Spencer was for local control. She supported a lot of the legislation that we had as she was an alderperson. So, it's always interesting what changes when people elevate to another level of power and authority, what happens. But, it is what it is. So, I've come across pictures as we do our, we're doing an archiving project for the Missouri State Historical Society, and I've come across pictures with her in it as we've struggled over that legislation. So so it's kind of like, when Trump says something and then you turns around and says something else, and you got a video clip or you got a video of them. So, it is what it is, but we're going to move forward. So.
Sure. And, the mayor is on the board by statute. Right. So I think that part of maybe what's changed, and this is, I think, yet to be determined, is whether it was Mayor Jones who had gotten reelected or Mayor Spencer, the people on the board are people that the mayor is to work with in some fashion. So I think another common lawyer thread, speaking of the profession of law, is people who are convinced it's possible to make change from the inside of something versus people who are attempting to challenge it from the outside. I'm rarely in a position where I'm on the inside of anything, so
I'm very. This will surprise you guys, but I'm very much an insider myself.
Sure. That's why we have you. I don't know. It's nice to brag, but yeah. So I think that it's always interesting to hear from people. It's always interesting to see people who are sort of clearly grappling with how can I fix this from the inside, or people who are just. Who are just in a position where they're doing something. So,
well, here's the thing. I think for some people who believe, as I do, in the illegitimacy of the police board of commissioners, the process, what the governor had done, is a certain point that you have to register some protest. And so I don't know the capacity in which Mayor Spencer could do that as an appointed board. She certainly doesn't have a vote. She, as far as I'm concerned, she's irrelevant on that board. And then you, particularly when you have all members of the board with some level of direct or indirect relationship with the police, I think it would have been behooving to her to say, hey, wait a minute. If I'm going to be on this board, it's got to look more representative than this. It's got to be more neutral. But yet to just fall in line without any opposition or resistance to me is unacceptable.
So I think something that is a hallmark of what happens when democratic controls are removed is that there is just a fundamental lack of transparency. And so I don't know, and I'm not going to pretend to know, are these the people that Mayor Spencer wanted on the board? Did she want different people on the board? Did she voice displeasure? Who did she voice displeasure to? We don't know the answer to any of those questions. We don't know how the governor arrived at these individuals. All we know is we end up with a board that is not representative of the city, is with people who have financial or social or professional or all of the above ties with the people they are to conduct oversight of. And then, like you said, we're hearing minimal, if no, pushback from city officials. And I think there is a lack of transparency about how those decisions were made. There's a lack of transparency about people's positions on the composition of the board. And that is obviously troubling when you're coming from an alternative of direct democratic control over, we vote for the mayor appoints the police chief, there is a straight line to organize, to create change in policies, change in whatever, of the people who have control over our lives, our bodies, our homes, etc.
And so, Brendan, isn't the conflict of interest that we see so blatant in our faces, isn't that pause for some kind of challenge, legal challenge, about the composition and the interest of self-interest and conflicting interests of the folks on the commission?
Yeah, so it's tough to answer that in a vacuum because it ends up being about what's before the board and what the board's deciding on and whether people are sort of appropriately recusing themselves. I think just not to broaden the conversation, but there's been a move all over our society towards sort of letting go of caring about these sorts of ethical concerns. So if you're asking, is it possible that one of these conflicts of interest could become a cause for litigation? Yeah, absolutely. I think it's possible to sort of, the deck is set up that way. It hasn't happened yet.
I would say that it's not part of either of our lawsuits, but it is sort of striking that the bill itself lays out certain procedures the governor was supposed to take, and then he just didn't follow any of the procedures. So, the bill says appoint these people right away, the Senate needs to confirm, like all of these different steps that just no one followed. And I always find it striking when people who are in charge of making other people follow rules don't follow their own rules.
That's right.
Yeah. And it's just a page out of the Trump playbook. It's like whatever laws are there and whatever institutional practices that are there, we are totally going to ignore them so we can do what we want to do, which to me already sets an ugly precedent about what we can expect from this board. So when I hear about, for example, the little kerfuffle around the body cams. Am I surprised? No. That there was a no bid process and the contract was let? Oh, no, I'm not surprised at all, because now we don't know what the process is. And so, again, when we get ready to try to tell people the differences between local control and state, all of that stuff we will not have access to anymore. And I don't even know if some of the older people will be able to get the information that they need. But what we do know is that the contract that is currently being considered is almost 10 times the original contract. So somebody's getting ready to make money off of us, and these are city dollars. And this is the thing that I tell our people, you got to watch your money. This is your money. This is not their money. Just because it's in their pockets now, you put it in their pockets, but you still expect some accountability about how it's being used. So let's keep an eye on that contract for the body cams. And just as a little editorial piece here, I am opposed to body cams as being the panacea for police accountability, because as we've known from incidents across the country, those cameras don't get turned on. They conveniently malfunction when police are doing wrong. So, you know, even when Ferguson was kicking off and people, let's get body cams, we're like, nope, that's not going to help us. You know, that's not going to help us.
And they capture only the police perspective.
Exactly.
So even when they do work, I always use Eric Garner as an example. Eric Garner's video was perfect. Had that been body cam footage, it would have been nothing but jostling, and it would have appeared very violent.
Mm-hmm. Right. It would appear that he was the aggressor and they were defending themselves.
That's correct. Thank goodness. Thank goodness there was somebody else there.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, yeah. So I'm just, that was just my little piece. But I know people think something magical happens when, you know, people have a camera. But as you said, if the camera's not in the right angle and not turned on, then what's the point of it all? And I think this contract is something like $25 million.
Yeah.
I mean, geez. What kind of surveillance are we trying to get here with a police department that claims that it's only a few of them, but the truth of the matter is we have more police per capita than most cities our size. So we are over-policed, and yet we still are not getting the services and the attention that we think we deserve. So it's a problem. This is an area that we have to continue to fight around. And speaking of that, why are you all in this fight? Why are you defending local control? Maureen.
Well, the first and most important reason is what I already alluded to about democratic controls and the importance of having ways for people to exercise agency and power over them. And so in a country where it feels like there's rapidly eroding norms around checks and balances, around your ability to get due process or challenge governmental actions, you know, local control provides a way for the people being policed to have say over what kind of policing is being done to them. And, you know, people who are, I don't want to be self-deprecating now from my client, but, you know, people who are wiser than me have pointed out that criminalization is sort of is a warning sign for fascism. So there are people who are worried about the direction that our country nationally is going in. And one of the only ways that that gets enabled is by granting an enormous amount of power to local police, local sheriffs, to sort of expand the dragnet of the criminal justice system. And, you know, I think in St. Louis City, we've had so many people who've worked so hard for so long to try to bring accountability, to try to bring to not just say, let's send out a truck with ice cream and that'll be cop community relationships, but like, how can we actually have some reciprocal power here? Obviously, I'm sitting next to one of the most important people in that journey. And so it feels like a real step backwards to say, well, no, never mind about all of that reciprocal power. We're just going to take it away, put it in the hands of the state board. The state board's going to be people. You know, we're just going to take it away from you locally. You don't get to control what happens to you. So I think that's why it matters to me. I think that's why it matters to our city. And I think just in general, very little progress can be made about tons of issues that are important to all of us if we are sinking so many resources into this expanding criminalization. So, you know, I as a person care a lot about bike safety, pedestrian safety. You know, I have two small kids. I like care a lot about traffic control and just our parks. And, you know, I care about all those things, but it's not, those things are at odds with requirements that our funding for the police go up and up and up and up and up, right? And so the things that you know, you might think to yourself, like, what does bike safety have to do with local control? And it's like, well, because we can't make the streets safer to ride on if all the money's going to the cops.
Yeah. And public safety is not just about more cops.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I think almost any issue you care about, if you're listening to this, if you care about an issue, it's going to be hard for you to make progress on that issue if Jeff City says every disposable dollar goes to $25 million contracts for body cams.
Hmm. And why are you here, Brendan Roediger?
Oh, you told me to.
I knew you were going to say something.
I guess I have a couple of answers. One is, Missouri has a Confederate legacy, and it has a Union legacy, it has an abolitionist legacy, and state control is a part of the Confederate legacy. And on a certain level, that's a good enough reason to be in the fight. I believe that there are of our opponents, our enemies, who are aware of that, who get a kick out of the fact that sort of these last vestiges of the Confederacy hold on. And so that's enough to get me mad and to get me working. I will also agree with Maureen. I have never lived through a period with a progressive mayor. I've never seen a mayor who's accountable to the people, and I have not seen progress on the issue of policing that actually translates to the streets. I have seen, sort of the same level of violence out of police every year. But that being said, our only hope is to someday reach that point where we do have democratic accountability, and where the work that you've done and so many people have done sort of comes to fruition. And that is an impossibility with the board.
And to that point, I'm looking at this is the point Marie made about the expanding nature of policing and law enforcement. It is an integral part of our life, of even in public spaces, that will become the norm unless we offer some resistance, some organized a fight back against that. And when I think about, for example, now, based on what the knuckleheads in Washington have done, ICE is now the biggest budget agency in modern history. So, and then we got trickles of money for human services. And so that, to me, that's saying a lot, and we can't ignore that. And we can't ignore the fact that ICE, when they get ready to hire those thousands of folks, I think they can hire up to 10,000, will be deployed in places like St. Louis. They will be supplementing and complementing police, as we saw happen in Los Angeles. So all of this, the fight back for local control is wrapped up in what we are trying to hold back going forward, and there is a tide, and we all are going against that tide, but we have to fight back against it, because otherwise we have a police state, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's right. I will say that early on in my legal career, I did some work with a certain type of visa that's available to people who are victims of crime. To encourage people, even if there's some concern about their immigration status, to go to police and to cooperate with police and to, not let crime just go silent, right? And this is something that police departments wanted because they are always complaining about people not talking to them, right? But it requires police departments to sort of take these active steps to support victims of crime. And I have reason to believe from my immigration attorney friends and from people in the community that, those steps, are going to vary dramatically for each police department, right? And so I don't say this to say I know for a fact sitting here today that St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department is going to take different actions to support victims of crime if they happen to be undocumented, but I say it more to say, well, how are any of us going to know, right? Like, because we don't have that direct pipeline anymore to say, we want you to help people get these kinds of visas. We want you to treat folks in this community that are immigrant or refugees this way. We want you to, you know, take steps, discretionary steps to support those communities instead of cooperate or, you know, otherwise engage ICE or other people, right? And so who is making those decisions now? It's the state board.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a direct line from the citizens of St. Louis, right? And St. Louis is, you know, a place that has sort of famous success stories of large number of immigrants coming and like enriching and beautifying and creating more vibrancy, right? And so who gets to make that call, right?
Yeah, but you know, when we look at how immigration is unfolding, the whole deportation thing, it is abundantly clear that it's not about immigration. Because many of the folks that they are rounding up and putting down there in that damn alligator Alcatraz, are citizens or who have legitimate pending papers and still. And so to me, the whole dragnet is really going to be about rounding up anybody that they want to round up, including dissidents, including, you know, there's brown people now, but it's going to be black people, you know, tomorrow. And so I think the expanding and broad nature of the way that the so-called mass deportation is happening is a contradiction, because first we were told that we're going to get the most violent and we're going to get these gang members, and we see that that is not the case, and it never really was the case. So here we are on the brink of a police state. So I'm going to, you know, bring us back to our case, because part of what I like to do is to explain to people the legal process, what happens when you file a lawsuit, what are the expectations, what do we expect as outcomes, and then today we got a date for a trial. So walk us through that, Brendan. What happened that we are here, and what are we expecting as plaintiffs, and what is you all's role as our defenders?
Yeah, so, and feel free to jump in. Today, I went to Jeff City on what we called a motion to set a trial date, which is exactly what it sounds like. And pretty much the only thing being discussed was, you know, saying, hey, Judge, this is an important issue. It's got to move pretty quickly. We understand that there's a fair amount of writing and a little bit of exchanging of information that needs to take place. But this can't, you know, a normal civil lawsuit in the state of Missouri, what do you think the average time is, Maureen?
Oh, Lord.
3 years?
Yeah, something like that.
Somewhere around there. Yeah. So, you know, this is not the sort of case where we can do that. We were hopeful for a date in late September or October. Mm-hmm. We got a date in November, which, you know, is not what we were hoping for, but is also not
what the state was hoping for,
which was a date in January or February. Right. So, as is so often the case, the judge sort of split it down the middle. That is the trial date. That is the date where we should be done with this case at this level, meaning in circuit court in Cole County in Jefferson City. And from there, the case would go up on appeal. I think it's very unlikely that this court is the last stop.
And so something about just like a big picture thing about this case is that often there is a difference between things you don't like about something and the legal claims you are bringing. I would say it's seldom that the thing I really want to put in my complaint is the actual legal claim, right? So I teach a class on civil rights law at SLU, and one of the things I talk about most of the time is how often, if it were just up to me, I would want to include a claim that's like needlessly difficult, right? Like this person is being difficult for no reason. That's not really a legal claim. It's just a thing that is frustrating. Although there's, I guess one could argue there's variations of that claim. But in this case, our claims are not our strategic, and our claims are the ones that we believe we can bring successfully. It's not it's not going to encompass everything that we're frustrated about or dislike. Like Brendan said, this lawsuit is a direct tie to the Confederacy. That's not a legal claim, but it is something that's wrong. So here, our legal claims are pretty limited to the provisions of this bill that we believe violate the Missouri Constitution in a variety of ways. And so what we are hoping for is that the judge agrees with us that the bill was wrong, was poorly done, was not done carefully enough, and says, no, you know, I'm invalidating the state takeover provision. What that's not going to stop, unfortunately, is if the judge or the appellate judge or the Missouri Supreme Court, which is almost certain, I think, who's going to have the last word here, says, yeah, you did this wrong. That's not going to stop the legislature from saying, like, okay, well, let's see if we can do it right. So this legal strategy can only ever be part of a power building, movement-based advocacy strategy, right? Because so if Brendan and I write the brief of our lives, you know, and convince the judge that the way they wrote out this bill violated what's called the Hancock Amendment, because of some of the funding requirements and the restrictions on our budget, our money, that this bill from Jeff City is mandating, that's not going to stop them from trying to find a different way to have state control over our police, right? And so even if we are 100% successful, we need that advocacy still from people convincing our state legislature not to preempt, not to take away, not to exercise these controls over St. Louis City.
So, Brendan, when we think about the takeaway and the process that was used, I know that inherently that it's wrong, morally, whatever, but again, these are legal claims. So the fact that there was already a law in place and that the majority of the people made sure that law was in place, is there nothing out there that you can hang your legal hat on to say that was illegal what you all just did?
So expand on that a little bit. You mean the fact that we had already gone through this sort of massive process to regain local control?
Further, what they claimed was the reason that they were so concerned was because of the rising violence and crime, when all along that was going down, so that was baseless. So now what do we have except for a real power grab? And so what I'm asking is there anywhere where there's some illegality about that process? Because here's what I think about. Here's what I think about.
You promised we wouldn't go into the weeds, and you're just dragging me by both hands right into them. So I'll go with you. So here's what I'll say about that. I think that this issue of, you know, just dealing with the same issue over and over again is you know, such a Missouri thing. I mean, we now see this sort of this race to have us voting on abortion again with a bill summary that's, you know, just entirely fraudulent. So, you know, and we literally just did that. And, you know, you've lived through, you know, Right to Work 1 and Right to Work 2. And, you know, that's Missouri. We do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results, right? And so I don't think there's a claim there. I don't think sort of the we already did this. As much as you and I both wake up saying, my God, why do we have to repeat the past every year? That's not a claim. We shouldn't have to live Groundhog's Day, but we do in Missouri. So there's nothing to do about that. I do think the sort of like, you know, what's the justification?
Yeah.
Is a part of our lawsuit, right? Like, what is what we use the phrase in the law, rational basis? What can you articulate state government, is the reason behind treating St. Louis differently. Clearly, the rising crime is not it, because we don't have that. Mm-hmm. So what is it? They're not allowed to say race. So what are they going to articulate? And the answer to that is we don't know.
Well, I'm thinking in the reverse of this. So, for example, part of the law says that elected officials cannot in any way interfere, or they will be criminally, not just civilly, criminally dealt with. And so I'm thinking, how is this different? If I'm an elected official and I say, hey, I know what you all said, but I'm going to do this because I think this is important for me to do. Why is there not some kind of reciprocity with how those folks are going to be responding? Because to me, it's really going to put a chill on the efforts of elected officials to even voice disagreement, let alone come up with some actions or some counter legislation against that. Because you're even just your voice can have them come after you. And I know I'm hoping somebody will be a test case. I don't know who that might be bold enough to do that. But I think we should test it. Okay, I'm an elected official. This is, I'm going to bring a proposed legislation in the board to say we're going to do this, change this part of y'all's bill. How would that be looked at?
Well, I have a list of four older persons I'd like you to call to propose that to, and I'll send it to you after we're done. I completely agree with that. I will say that, even if, we were to be successful, it remains the fact that their power is greater than our power. And so that sort of leverage, those sorts of threats happen outside of the legal system all the time, right? You don't do what we say here, and we're going to pull your money here. Mm-hmm. That sort of defines state governments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, in a federalist system, we are the city of St. Louis, which is both a city and a county, and some would argue more of its own thing than a part of the state of Missouri, unfortunately, frequently finds itself reminded that it is under the thumb of the great state of Missouri. I mean, it's a weird phenomenon because much like when you look at the Electoral College map nationally, right? You'll see this sort of sea of red and these sort of blue areas if you just look at this kind of geographic, but then when you look at population centers, it looks very different. And I think similarly, Missouri these days is thought of as this deep red state, when really a lot of the population, a lot of the commerce, a lot of the resources come out of urban centers that are being targeted in ways that both Brendan and I have argued are irrational by these sort of special laws that are only applicable to the city of St. Louis. So aren't, if you're driving down to St. Francis County, no one's appointing a state board to look at the crime there. You're just drawing a circle around the two urban centers and making them have different rules than everyone else. And that's something that, in theory, the Missouri Constitution prevents.
So, one of the things that's been extremely hard over the years is to get people to be organized around police accountability, just for that reason, because the retaliation can be swift, unseen, unheard. You just feel it. And and then there's no recourse. So the fact that, for example, for years we would, try to get people to go down and file a complaint regardless of what the issue was. And first of all, you have to go to the police department, sign in, go to the sixth floor, be scrutinized by all the popo as you're going up. Really? And then you get to the Internal Affairs Department, and they're looking at you all gruff and ugly, mugging you, like, what you here for? And some folks that we know have even seen their complaints thrown in the trash right in front of them, like, this is not really a complaint. So we worked so hard to get an independent review board, a civilian oversight board, to start looking at this. And you wouldn't believe the number of complaints that start coming in because people say, aha, it's not just the popo, you know, doing it for themselves and looking at it and say, okay, there's no nothing here. But you had citizens who were looking at that. You had people that were investigating it. We made sure they had subpoena power. So now all of that is got a smack upside the head, and we're trying to figure out now with the Civilian Oversight Board what will be their powers. And so that's, that remains to be seen. But my point is, like, trying to get people engaged and involved has been a challenge, but we have to. So the Civilian Oversight Board meetings are are Zoom. So even if you can't, like, participate or go to them, you can look at them later, see how what they're doing, how they're doing it. But tomorrow we have the meeting, the first meeting of the new board. It was going to, guess what time it's going to be and guess where it's going to be. It's going to be at 9 a.m. Tomorrow morning, you all, down at the Popo headquarters at 1915 Olive. So you're going to have to go through those intimidating doors. They don't intimidate me. I'm going to drive right on up there if I can, if I and go in there and watch what they do and watch how they conduct business. That we have to do this, y'all. We these people are claiming to serve at our interest, and we have to see. And when they don't, we have to say, no, you're not. No.
So one thing that's been a puzzle to me that I am going to use this radio show as an opportunity to say is that there's a lot of uncertainty with the bill. And so you can see in different parts of the city government functioning, people are trying to figure out what does this bill mean. And of course, I'm hoping it just goes away. But for example, as a lawyer, I can tell you that there's the city, the St. Louis City Councilor's Office, which again is an, in theory an institution with a direct link to the people. We vote for the mayor appoints the city councilor, the mayor can fire the mayor can direct the city councilor. Or at least I believe the mayor can direct the city council. That that feels confusing to many.
Sometimes.
But
our former mayor never did learn that. But
yeah, our former mayor was a little confused on that, which might, you know. But so, for example, I learned this week, this is not my case, but like I learned this week that there's all of these cases against SLMPD from before state takeover. So cases during the period of local control where all of a sudden the AGs, the Missouri Attorney General, is entering on those cases saying like, oh, we're going to take these cases now. And here's the thing about, and I'm just saying this as a taxpayer, these are cases that expose the city to a tremendous amount of liability. These are cases where resolution of those cases in a humane way would mean a lot to city residents. And why...
Tens of millions of dollars.
Yes. And so why, when I cannot, as a lawyer, figure out what the statutory basis for this, why is the Spencer administration saying, oh yeah, I guess the AGs can just make decisions about whether to... to settle these cases, for example, or whether to try these cases. And it's sort of this complying in advance thing that it's not like there has to, like, some of it is what you, things become real when you just let them be real, right? So if we all just say, I guess the state board doesn't have to turn over any documents, maybe that will be true. Right. But if
that will become the practice, which then will become the
right. And if we say, I guess the Missouri Attorney General just makes decisions about lawsuits that could greatly impact the financial health of our city where we live, where we pay taxes, that just becomes true. And I think that there is a certain level of transparency and candor we need from our city government about why, what exactly they're changing, what power they're handing over, and why are they handing over this power.
So, Maureen, as you were talking, I'm feeling the hair stand up on the back of my neck because I already know, because some of us have been in a fight with the AG's office around wrongful convictions. And how they want to treat those or not treat them, but how is that not an issue that you're taking away local control of even that piece of it. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what the basis is for the AG's office being able to take those cases.
Well, certainly I don't understand. I mean, there's some argument about cases from here on forward, right? Like, let's say cases that, so, okay, now we've got the state board again. Now maybe the AG is from here forward. But 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, when it was local control, what, I mean, if the incident happened during local control, what is the basis for removing local control from lawsuits arising out of those incidents? I don't get that at all. Maybe Brendan, who's so much brighter than me, as I think we've established earlier in this call.
If I were to channel my good friends at the Attorney General,
sure.
You know, I think they would take, you know, certainly, you know, I mean, if we look at the actual statutory language, the statutory language envisions that the board itself would be constituted, would meet, and would then invite the Attorney General into litigation. So we already know that hasn't happened because the Attorney General was entering in litigation before the board ever formally met. But I think what they would say is that the state has now taken control of any debts or potential debts of the city, and that by virtue of that, they're entitled to enter. I don't agree with that. I think that's what they would say.
Mm. So, Brendan, do you, taking control of any debts, what do you think?
But not to pay them.
Yeah, I was about to say. So I'm just putting on my city taxpayer hat.
And there's a very good appellate case that came out yesterday that refers to this trying to get paid as three card Monty, which is great language from Judge Dowd, sort of talking about this game that gets played between the city and the state with these people who are in this limbo of, you know, who's responsible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's another piece of this all, right? Like, if you're it's kind of like a job employment program for lawyers, right? So I guess it's going to keep us all busy trying to figure out what any of this means.
I just want to point out, I said Judge Dowd like there weren't 700 of them and everybody would know who I was talking
about. Sure, sure. Sure. Raise your hand if you know a Judge Dowd.
Yeah. Or if you are Judge Dowd.
Yeah, Judge Dowd, all of them, I assume.
Well, the real Judge Dowd stand up.
Yeah.
But I think this to me really points to what is happening right in front of our eyes in terms of pulling away citizen input, citizen control, local control to not just, even if we had a Democratic governor at the state level, I would be opposed to what's happening. It's not just because Kehoe is a MAGA, you know, governor, and that we got a trifecta here where, you know, all of the state and the Senate is controlled by Republicans. But it's just, you know, wrong in terms of the way citizens respond to and participate in a democracy, that all of this is starting to crumble. And if we don't really fight hard, we're going to see more brazen attempts to do that because people won't know what's happening, or they won't know that that's against the law, or at least it's unethical or immoral, but not to even like stop it or intervene or pay attention is going to be really not a good thing for the rest of us. It's going to be okay for the folks in power because then they'll have all the ducks lined up. So when they do have a problem, they got friends in those places to make sure that they get out of it. But it's not really looking that good for us. And the only thing that I think, I'm serious, and I just have to be honest with you all and I have to be honest with my listeners and the people that I come in contact with, but that doesn't mean that we have to be disillusioned or, you know, stay in frustration mode. That just means we got to change our mode of organizing, because this is a new reality, y'all. We are on the brink of fascism, and if you don't understand the way that rolls out, there's plenty of memes on social media that have helped really make it very simple in terms of what happened in Nazi Germany in less than, like, I think it was less than 35 days or something like that Hitler was able to do what he did. you know, when you got people that are sleeping or confused or whatever, it's going to be easy to ram this stuff through. And so we got to be woke, even though they're trying to make that illegal. But, you know, I'm going to be woke and I'm going to be active. And hopefully when I disappear, y'all going to say, call Maureen and Brendan, because those are her attorneys, so they got to find her. What detention center she is? And I'm laughing because you really have to laugh to keep from, like, you know, blowing your stack. But this is real, y'all. This is totally real. And I do want to thank my guests for coming on and helping us to understand not just the elements of the case around local control, but putting it in the context of where we are in this country and why we have to fight the way we do. So you could hear this again. We thought we would be streaming, but somehow or another that didn't work, but we got the audio. And any audio that you want to hear from this radio show or previous ones will be at JamalaRogers.com. We got a few things coming up, y'all. Tomorrow, again, I'm going to mention, get down to that police station and see the first board. Now, somebody told me that they're not even have been ratified or whatever it is, approved by the Senate, but they're going ahead as if they're legitimate. So already they're a legal entity. So let me just put that out there. So, so they're not even officially approved. But also, you know, on Sunday, the Organization for Black Struggle is continuing their breathwork and meditation series. Y'all, we gotta have some valves to unleash the pressure and steam and stress that we are feeling in these stressful times. And so this particular series is helping us to learn how to breathe differently, how to find some solace in our own hearts and minds and spaces. And really, it's been helpful. I've been participating in them, because if I didn't, y'all, somebody might not be in front of me long. They might have hit the ground or something. I'm serious. You know, this is getting ridiculous. And you feel frustrated because there's no one person that you really can.
Sure.
It's like the system. And so that's why we have to understand the systems of oppression. For those of you all who've been part of the tornado relief, there's still stuff going on. Some people trying to get some rest. But tomorrow, some of us will be at Fountain Park because they have a digital day, which is helping folks who've been victims of the storm to have access to folks from the St. Louis Development Corporation, using their expertise to find out where you can get some help. And FEMA's there as well. There's FEMA agents there. We're going to be providing some meals for folks because the city, for whatever reason, took the food trucks away. So the Organization for Black Struggle is raising money to make sure people have some food tomorrow. So tomorrow, 12 to 5, come to Fountain Park. A lot of stuff going on, but particularly it's digital day. You'll have access to computers so you can look up stuff online, you know, contact your insurance company, all that stuff. They'll be there for people to help you. So if I miss anything, we're going to put that on my website too, under events, just because we need to have some relief, y'all. We need to be in community with folks who are doing what they're supposed to be doing, but the healing is only going to be through community. And so stay tuned for more about that. But want to thank my guest again, Brendan Roediger and Maureen Hanlon, who's unrelated to Stephen Hanley.
no current known relation.
Yeah.
Ancestrally related.
Yeah. So we want to make sure that you all stay safe. Ooh, that's loud, y'all. But this is Jamala, and your humble host, and I will see you on the battlefield. I'm not going to do that.